This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymph. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw!
Hi, Benji. I'm glad you could join me in this season of generosity and gift-giving to hear Strobus discuss what he is doing to support more presence in our relationships. Pun intended.
Senility and the art of being in the here and now. Achieving transcendence at last. I know how, 'cause I'm getting there fast. I'm comfortably numb about what's still to come, and I can't recall shit from the past.
<Hee-haw>. I know what you mean. When we reach a certain age, presence is all we have left.
Laugh when folks claim doom's a hoax. Seek distraction from favorite strokes. Try to pretend that this isn't the end. At some point, you run out of jokes. Hee-haw.
No, Benji, I don't believe you'll ever run out of jokes. But anyway, Strobus will be talking more about presence in space, how we can put artificial intelligence to work to manage our virtual lives so that we can focus more on the flesh and blood world. So, Strobus, welcome back. Talk to me about presence.
Presence is a startup business. I'm at the very early stages of it. I've done a lot of conceptual work over the past several months as I'm on a kind of sabbatical, extended sabbatical from the working world. It arises from an observation about our society, probably more than just the American society, but worldwide, that we are getting sucked into a sort of electronic online vortex that it has begun to steal or absorb all of our attention. There's 24 hours in a day, and those are irreplaceable. There's nothing you can do to retrieve time. And social media is absorbing greater and greater chunks of that. And it got me really curious as to, well, why is that? Why are these tools so effective at sucking people down this rabbit hole? And furthermore, my own experience with social media is that it's really not a great experience at a human level. For our human nature. My experience with social media is that even though I was connected to, I think in the peak of my Facebook usage, I was connected to like 500 people. I felt like I wasn't actually really connected to most of them. And I felt lonely and a bit isolated. And I also felt like I was at the whim of this platform to give me my self-esteem such that like if I'd post something or I'd comment on something, I really wanted to see a strong reaction to it in order to feel good about myself. And I just didn't like the fact that there was this platform intermediary that was driving me to think that way. And I know that's not the experience of everyone. Probably the more effective you are at social media in terms of garnering lots of attention and reaction, the more fulfilling it is. But I know a great many people are not satisfied, not happy, even though it feels like they should be. And that's a really strange thing.
You know, you might be looked at askance and have trouble with social advance if you're fated to see lies with your own honest eyes from outside the consensus trance. Hee-haw!
The studies are now coming out. The scientific community is, and the psychological community is starting to realize that, yeah, these platforms are actually highly attuned to what motivates us and drives us. And that's ultimately, in the neurochemical sense, that's the dopamine hits that we get when people react to our postings, you know, in this kind of pseudo interactive environment. And dopamine feels good, but there's something missing there. And it's ultimately, I think, the actual human connection, the hearing of people's voices, the body language. I think there's been a few studies now that even video conferencing systems like this don't provide the same level of human interaction as an in-person meeting. And so our brains are not evolved to deal with this electronic medium as a way of interacting with other human beings to fulfill our social needs. And yet the social platforms are taking the place of real social interaction. So now a few people who have worked in those giant social media companies and giant internet companies have come forward, and these companies are actually hiring psychologists and neuroscientists to advise them on how to tune their algorithms and how to tune their artificial intelligence to be more effective at absorbing our attention and distracting us from our lives. And that's because the more attention we give them, the more advertising money they make. And the reality of the corporate world is that the imperative for a corporation is to make a profit. Its directors have a fiduciary duty to make decisions and guide the company in directions that make money for the shareholders. And if they don't do that, there is legal precedent that those directors can be sued. And so there's a strong direction there in terms of we have to do everything we can to absorb people's attention to maximize our advertising revenue.
It's important to note that maximizing profit wasn't always the prime directive of the corporate world. As we learned from John Perkins, our featured guest on Sequitur Perception early this past summer, John is an elder, a shaman, a co-founder of the Pachamama Alliance, and author of The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Listen with me now to this 2-minute clip from that show.
There was one moment in 1976 when everything changed. And that's where the problem came. When I went to business school before 1976, I was taught that a good CEO makes a decent rate of return for investors and takes good care of his employees, gives them health care insurance and retirement pensions, and is a good community citizen, pays taxes, imagine that, donates money to schools and recreational facilities. A good citizen serves the public interest. I was taught that a good company is a good public servant. And that was being ground down. It was being changed. A guy won the Nobel Prize from the Austrian School of Economics named Hayek in the early 70s. And there was this beginning movement to move away from that idea. But it was capped in 1976 when Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize in Economics. And Friedman said a lot of things, but the most important thing he said was that the only responsibility, the only goal of business is to maximize shareholder profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs. And it had been building up this idea along those lines, but he sealed it. And when he got the Nobel Prize, it opened the door for President Reagan and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and other world leaders to totally buy into this concept. And since then, every president of the United States, every major leader, Democrat, Republican, conservative, progressive, whatever, have basically bought into this. And all the big corporations have bought into it. And so we've got a system now, today, that says the only responsibility of business is to maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. To hell with the employees. To hell with the customers. To just maximize profits. To hell with the local communities. And that's a perception. But it was changed. It occurred that pivotal moment, and we can turn that around.
But like me, you are not so inclined to turn that around. We are more of the Bucky Fuller orientation of creating a new model that sidesteps those legal precedents of which you spoke. So tell our listeners more about how you plan to do that.
So presence is an answer to that. It's a solution. It's a buffer. And we'll see where it leads. I've got a lot of ideas about where it might lead. And I'm an idealist, but I'm also practical. I definitely live in the current day, so I know where I'm at. But I can see a big future for agents that mediate between our brains, between ourselves, and the ever-growing, ever more complicated electronic world that calls ever more effectively for our attention. We need an agent that can mediate that. And that agent can only be an agent that works for us and only us. It has our interests in the heart of its algorithms. All of its optimizations are to enhance our lives rather than distract us from our lives. And so bringing that same technology that is on the big internet companies is being used to learn how to distract and absorb your attention as much as possible, using that same technology to defend your attention and to provide what it is you need from the online world without all the other distractions. So filtering out all of the noise and getting more of the signal. Mm-hmm. So that's the mission of Presence. And I'm setting it up as a public benefit corporation. This is to avoid the problem of as soon as the money arrives, the mission is to make money. So I've just articulated a clear mission. And when the money arrives, from what I've seen, that's no longer going to be the mission. The mission is going to be make money. And there will be lots of pressure to shortcut the mission I articulated to go in whatever direction makes the money and gets the investors their quickest path to exit, or if it turns out to be what they call a unicorn, they stay on for the ride and they ride it all the way up to astral heights and whatever else. And I'm not interested in that at all. I don't need to make gigantic amounts of money. I just need to make a living, and I want to make a living doing this. So it is a for-profit company, a public benefit corporation. It's called a B Corp. It's a for-profit, but as part of its bylaws, it has the mission of the company. And these corporations were set up in a response to the court rulings that the directors of corporations had a fiduciary duty to make profits for the shareholders, and that was their only duty. These laws were set up in like 2010. In Massachusetts, it was 2012. And there's a handful of states that have legal systems in place to create B Corps. And the directors of B Corps are allowed and expected to take into account the mission of the company as part of the decision-making process, even if it means that the profits won't be as high.
I have two things to add to this piece. First, you have articulated a mission to overcome an observable problem in the world. I will reiterate your mission as it appears on your website. At Presence, our mission is to give you the tools you need to maintain a strong presence in the human world without sacrificing your presence in the digital world. Your personal AI acts as your agent and interface to the increasingly automated world while supporting your activities in the real world. In other words, your personal AI maintains your online presence so you can be more present in the here and now. It learns your unique interests, goals, and aspirations, and then interacts with the digital world to support them. Unlike the AI created by giant internet companies who work for advertisers, personal AI works for you, for your benefit, and to support what you are doing in your life rather than to distract you from it. Second, there are far more than a handful of states that license B corporations. I found my way to benefitcorp.net and learned that entrepreneurs can apply for B Corp status in 32 states and the District of Columbia, with legislation pending in Alaska, Georgia, Iowa, Mississippi, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. So instead of listing all those states, I'll list the 12 that are still not on board with this movement. They are Alabama, Colorado, Maine, Michigan, Missouri, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, South Dakota, Tennessee, Washington, and Wisconsin. If any entrepreneurs are listening from those states, please take note and talk to your representative to your state legislature. So, can you go into more depth about what attracted you to the B Corp model?
We create the balance there between the profit motive and the wanting to do good in the world and heal. It's injecting the medicine work into the corporate construct. And so I think that's really important. I think the corporate world is not going away anytime soon. You know, in fact, if anything, it's accelerating, and we need to inject the best of ourselves into it. It's just not going to be possible to say, oh, that's, you know, the way that is bad, and we need to do something else, you know, something completely different. For example, go back to indigenous ways is one of the things I hear. Not going to happen. We have our modern society, and we can bring the best of indigenous ways into that and figure out, to the extent that they make us better human beings, more responsible, better stewards of each other and of ourselves and of the world around us, we should bring that into the corporate structures that are not going to go away. And that will heal them from the inside. And I believe that is the only way possible.
Getting back to the theme of your discomfort with the penetration of Facebook and the hijacking of your attention to it, and what you didn't say that I'm going to put in here, I noticed maybe 6 months ago or whatever, you were on Facebook sabbatical. You actually dropped out for the longest time, seemed like to me, and then you came back. And I'm wondering if that Facebook sabbatical was the necessary condition for this idea of presence to emerge in you.
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of it, right? And that, you know, this is another kind of aspect of medicine work, is that everything I am, everything I bring into the world is my medicine. It's what I'm presenting to the world. So sure, my Facebook sabbatical was certainly part of that. The Facebook sabbatical was just purely a recognition of, like, this isn't working for me. And I have to do what's right for me, regardless of what the rest of the world is doing and is valuing. And so I dropped out, I think it was in 2014. It was the second time I had dropped out. I started on Facebook, I think, for the first time in like 2009 or something. Dropped out in like 2011. Didn't feel very good about it. Just like, God, this is a waste of time. You know, I'm not feeling good here. But when I got involved with the Evolver Network, a lot of their events were being organized on Facebook. And so, like, it became one of the only ways to really participate in the real world. And Evolver was all about getting people together in the real world. So I was all for that. You know, that's what I wanted more of. So I rejoined Facebook, and it just cascaded and took off like wildfire. I mean, I got all kinds of friends from Evolver, and then family and old high school people, and just like this total mishmash of different people. And it was just a culture clash, almost like for me, like an identity crisis, you know, like I was a different person to different groups of people on the platform. I was my kind of Evolver self, looking for like social change and like where are we headed, like socially, and how do we build a better world for ourselves and our kids and do it in a responsible way and in a sacred way that respects the world around us. And then my high school group and, of course, our family. I explicitly left my work crowd out of everything. I did all my professional networking on LinkedIn. So it was a very fracturing kind of experience. And after a while, I felt a little paralyzed in terms of what can I share, you know, because it was just like, there were just too many, it was too different across all those people. So
that seems to be important to most people's creative process. There needs to be a crash and recovery sort of cycle before these innovations and, you know, the growth experience of creating something new. You don't create it out of the blue. You create it in response to a need.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, you know, I think the fracturing was more about finding a way forward for myself than it was about looking for some solutions to anything. I mean, at that point, I was just, you know, very steeped and very involved in projects in the corporate world and trying to please my corporate masters, and wasn't really thinking about going off and doing something myself. I have to start the company. I have to set the culture. And that's kind of what I learned on the sabbatical. So I didn't have any idea what that would be. So presence just arrived as an idea from the observations and from what I'm experiencing in my kids, which is that I think their exposure to the electronic world has not been good for their development. And, you know, this has kind of taken us by surprise as parents, because we didn't have it when I was growing up. This level of engagement with devices is unprecedented. There's no parenting paradigm around it yet. I mean, it's developing. There's really some really good tools coming out to help parents deal with the attraction of these devices. And so looking at their experience, I think they really enjoy it. but I see also what they're missing out on. And there are studies and observations from parents and scientists that are showing that kids are not even really socializing anymore. Young adults are having less sex than ever. They're not leaving their houses to go out. And that's overstating it, of course. Of course there's people out, but it's quite reduced. And the drop has been steep. And it looks like it's a different order of magnitude and a different profile, but it resembles what happened in the 50s when television took off. The degree to which people started isolating at that point. Social scientists have started to study this, and now that enough time has passed, the evidence is there.
In the course of my search for an image to use for the Panina page for this show, I was drawn to a website I want to share with our listeners. I was especially interested in the effects of absorption by technology on what has come to be known as the iGen, the generation that follows the millennials. The generation to which my grandchildren belong, the generation who can't read paper maps and analog clocks, who are taught generic printing rather than developing a unique script handwriting style, who are not learning to share a family car or a hardwired landline phone, but instead are given personal devices. The URL is theconversation.com/us/topics/screen-time-12193. That's complicated, so I'll spell it out on the Panina page for this show. Here's a sample of the articles you will find linked there. In a post dated 17 August 2016, titled How Companies Learn What Children Secretly Want, Faith Boninger, Research Associate in Education Psychology at the University of Colorado, and co-author Alex Molnar, Director of Publications for the National Education Policy Center, write that even when children are working on their school assignments, unbeknownst to them and to their parents and teachers, the software they are using is collecting data for individualized marketing of junk foods and other products. In a post dated 21 August 2017 titled How the Smartphone Affected an Entire Generation of Kids, author Gene Twenge, professor of psychology at San Diego State University, writes that the iGen differs significantly even from the millennials on a range of measures from mental health to time spent with friends. And most recently, in a post dated 14 November 2017, titled, With Teen Mental Health Deteriorating Over 5 Years, There's a Likely Culprit, Twenge reports that according to a new analysis, the number of U.S. teens who felt useless and joyless grew 33% between 2010 and 2015, and there was a 23% increase in suicide attempts. As Strobus pointed out, and as his own experience demonstrates, the generations that have gone before are not immune. My attention was first drawn to the severity of the problem by the early October UK Guardian Weekend Magazine Technology Special article by investigative journalist Paul Lewis, titled, Our Minds Can Be Hijacked, The Tech Insiders Who Fear a Smartphone Dystopia. The URL is theguardian.com/technology/2017/oct/05/smartphone-addiction-silicon-valley-dystopia. Again, you can find that URL spelled out on the Panina page for this show. Of course, I knew about the problem before October, but I don't think I took it seriously until I heard it from the hearts of the techies themselves. Finally, a team of concerned former tech insiders and CEOs who intimately understand the culture, business incentives, design techniques, and organizational structures driving how technology hijacks us are building a new organization dedicated to reversing the digital attention crisis and realigning technology with humanity's best interests. Before I give you that URL, however, it is worth pointing out two key differences between their organization, called Time Well Spent, and Presence. One is that despite its clear public service mission, Time Well Spent is organized as a not-for-profit,
with the consequent additional layers of bureaucracy and adherence to the growth culture, rather than as a public benefit corporation like Presence. And the other is that I see no evidence of individualized use of artificial intelligence or AI, but rather a top-down, one-size-fits-all determination of what humanity's best interests might be. In fact, time well spent appears to be yet another consulting, coaching, and consciousness-raising endeavor. It is not clear if they're even offering a product, but I signed up for their newsletter anyway. That URL is timewellspent.io, and it is also spelled out on the Panina page for Sequitur Presence. Before we complete our discussion of Presence, let's have a musical interlude with Peter, Paul, and Mary's arrangement of a traditional seasonal song that is variously known as a solan or Hey Ho Nobody Home. I especially like the guitar solo introduction and the way the two guitars are blended before the vocals come in. And of course, the harmonies are exquisite.
Money have I none, get your wee be merry. Hey ho, nobody home. Ding dong, ding dong, money have I none, get your wee be merry. Hey ho, nobody home. Hey ho, nobody home. Soul, a soul, a soul cake. Please, good missus, a soul cake. An apple, a pear, a plum, a cherry. Any good thing to make us all merry. One for Peter, two for Paul, three for him who made us all. God bless the master of this house and the mistress also, and all the little children that round your table grow. The cattle in your stable, the dog by your front door, and all that dwells within your gates, we wish you 10 times more. Soul, soul, soul cake. Please, good missus, a soul cake. An apple, a pear, a plum, a cherry. Any good thing to make us all merry. One for Peter, two for Paul, three for him who made us all. Go down into the cellar and see what you can find. Get the barrels on our barrels. We hope you will be kind. We hope you will be kind with your apple, with your bed. For we'll come no more, we'll sow no more till this time next year. Soul, a soul, a soul cake. Please, good missus, a soul cake. Apple, a pear, a plum, a cherry. Any good thing to make us all merry. One for Peter, two for Paul, three for him who made us all.
The streets are very dirty, my shoes are very thin. Haven't got a penny, a halfpenny will do. If you haven't got a halfpenny, then God bless you.
Soul, a soul, a soul cake. Please, good missus, a soul cake. An apple, a pear, a plum, a cherry. Any good thing to make us all merry. One for Peter, two for Paul, three for him who made us all.
So the Lord sings praises, all these good misses, a soul cake.
An apple, a pear, a plum, a cherry. Any good thing to make us all merry.
You just heard Peter, Paul, and Mary sing A Solan. You'll find the lyrics on the Panina page for this show. There is some controversy about applying it to the Christmas holiday, because its origin with the Celtic tradition of wassail appears to be more closely related to Halloween and trick-or-treat and the ensuing Dia de los Muertos, or All Souls. However, from what I can tell, wassail, or the begging of food to honor the dear departed, could be appropriate starting on the Eve of All Souls, aka Hallowed Eve, or in modern parlance, Halloween, and extending through Christmas, or at least through the solstice. That's why I call it a seasonal song, and not a Christmas song or a trick-or-treat song.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
So now let's look at this personal AI presence tool from another perspective.
So words are always approximations.
Yes.
I can describe to you the taste of an apple, and it will never make you actually experience that taste. I can talk for days on the taste of an apple, and you'll never taste it. To me, that means that at least the cognitive linguistic centers in the brain, which are so dominant in our thinking process and our self-identification, are unable to really convey the full richness of experience, which means that we need to figure out how to get what we need from the electronic world in ways that don't absorb us completely, you know, so extensively, in ways that allow us to get back to our lives, to get back to that full sensory richness so that we feel complete as human beings.
So that we actually experience life rather than being this level of removal from it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm always thinking in terms of language and language abuse. And I'm really kind of annoyed with the New Age movement who talks about, you know, would you share, blah, blah, blah. You're not sharing it. You may be describing it, but you are not sharing
it. Right. You can give someone a sense, but what happens for the other person is that they immediately fill in their own experiences and projections. Right. Not saying that in a negative way. It's just part of relating to other people as human beings. In fact, we should celebrate that. It's a problem when we force our projections on the other person. That's not good. That doesn't help the other person. But we can have our internal process. Like, I can describe my experience of it. Oh, God, I love apples. They're so great. And you can appreciate that in your own experience of apples. But I can't say this is how you should experience an apple, and you can't tell me how I should experience an apple. They are separate experiences.
And the other hazard is unacknowledged projection. Not realizing that you're doing it and you're doing it. If you describe to me the taste of an apple, and I've never tasted an apple, and I taste an unknown piece of fruit, and I say that must be an apple because Jason's experience that he described to me sounds like the experience I'm having right now, and it's not an apple at all.
Right.
It could be something entirely else, but I'm still going to call it an apple because I've projected that experience onto this story you told me about the taste of an apple.
Well, I think that whole conundrum is one of the big sicknesses in our world, is the projection conundrum, where people are mistaking their internal, their own experience for what they believe must be going on for someone else. And that just takes conversations off the rails. It destroys relationships. It's such a insidious kind of really tricky, it's a mistake, you know, not a mistake, but a misidentification. In fact, that whole experience of I is a self-reflection. I'm this, I'm that. Our consciousness happens before the sense of I. Like, for instance, you can build a continuous trajectory of your consciousness from your earliest memories, and you can realize that that consciousness without the sense of I has been constant your entire life. And what has actually developed in your life and grown up is the sense of yourself, your egoic self, you know, your social self, all that. There's layers on top of that primordial kind of central awareness. And so when you're a baby, when you're an infant, you haven't developed all those extra layers. You're just that awareness. We don't actually even have a sense of I for the first several months of our lives. We start to build that when we realize that there's something here that seems to be me, that is attached to me and goes with me. And there's other things that don't seem to go with me. They are something else. They're other.
Hee-haw! How animals work. Creatures by methods arcane evolve different ways to maintain. But all their perspectives reflect two objectives, pursue pleasure and avoid pain. Hee-haw!
So one of the things I'm thinking of doing with the design, this is a conceptual direction that it may take, and I want to get your input on it because I know you have a lot of experience and have done a lot of thinking about this particular topic. So I believe that part of the isolation problem with social media as it is today is because we are emphasizing the individual, and we're already a very individualistic culture. And I think that that lends itself to more feelings of isolation. The social media platforms treat you, the individual node on the network, as the center of the universe. You are the center of your social media existence, especially on platforms like LinkedIn. Everything is set in terms of degrees of separation from you. It's really explicit there. On Facebook, it's less explicit, but it's still like you log in and there's you and your page and your profile and how everything else relates to you. And I think that's great. It's not that we need to get rid of that, but the concept I want to go with is to emphasize the relationship as the unit of currency of the social network. So your relationships with other people become the means of gaining that dopamine hit. So instead of keeping track of how many likes your post got, it keeps track of the relationship between you and another person or a group and what the statistics are about that relationship, so that you can see your strongest relationships. You can see relationships that you're neglecting, at least in social media sense. And I also want to emphasize relationships that are also offline relationships to give people a sense of who they can go to get more connected in the real world, especially the people that we know are suffering with this. I have friends who are psychologists and other types of healers, and they are saying that many people are starting to come to them with problems with social media addiction and feelings of isolation and depression because of social media. Those people are suffering. So emphasizing the relationship as the main idea of the network. You can't have a network without relationships. I know you've studied Charles Eisenstein quite a bit and sacred economics, and part of this is figuring out how to create a little stimulus, some dopamine activity with the relationship. And I'm considering for the individual, just representing them as a bundle of strengths, assets, you know, in the sense of here are my skills, here are my strengths, here are my ideas, topics I like to talk about, things like that. And also here are my needs. You know, I really need more information on 15th century horsehair paintbrushes, you know, something obscure, or it doesn't even have to be obscure. Like, you just want to connect with people around this. So you desire connection around a particular thing. So I want to model the individual with respect to their needs and assets.
I would refer you to Alpha Low and the gift circle model.
Okay.
Because you just described it perfectly.
Right.
And the danger with social media and even with gift circle implementations that I've been part of in the real world is the temptation to take a marketing approach, which is I present my assets first and my needs second. Mm-hmm. My needs are a step into vulnerability. To expose myself as needy is a step into vulnerability. Most people are very uncomfortable doing that. Nevertheless, if you first go to the assets and gifts rather than the needs, you end up basically selling a bill of goods.
Right. And everybody's got super assets and gifts and no needs.
Right.
Yes. I've seen that happen in sharing circles where you're invited to share a highlight and a low light. And the first person shares a highlight and then everyone else shares a highlight because the first person did. Instead of if the first person shared both, then everyone else would feel a little more comfortable sharing both.
In an Alpha Low gift circle, the way we bolster a person's confidence in making that step into vulnerability is before you even do the sharing circle, you break into small groups and you basically rehearse your needs with just one partner. And you help each other to articulate the need that you're going to bring to the circle so that when you get back into the circle and present that need, it comes out in a succinct and coherent way. And you don't go to gifts until all the needs are on the table.
Right. That's awesome.
What happened to me as you were describing what it is you're trying to do is I flashed on Google Analytics. And also a little bit of fear washed over me about commodification. I fear that we're making people into commodities.
Yeah, this would, in a sense, make relationships into commodities. Yeah, I've definitely been thinking about that. Like, what does that mean? You know, do you commodify? Do you monetize? And if you do, and so this is part of the public benefit aspect, the benefit will go to the parties involved in the relationship, not to the company. I mean, the company benefits because, like any of these companies, presence will benefit by just people using it. The increase in perceived value is what will benefit presence. So interestingly, a good source of needs and vulnerability is Google search. People open up their Google search history to me, which I'm going to request they do for their personal AI to examine, but not to publicize. That's private. People are very, very vulnerable and honest with Google search. And there's been studies about this too. Like, they look at in aggregate what people are sharing on Google search versus what they're sharing on social networks. And it's a stark difference. People go to Google search with their needs. So this is one of the problems I want to solve, is that Google search comes back and says, oh, I've got 39,500,000 results for that. And the person only has time to look at the first page.
Right? That's all I look at.
So obviously a machine can read thousands and thousands of search results very quickly. And if that machine is an AI that has your best interest in mind, that's not trying to sell you anything, it can figure out which of those thousands and thousands of results are actually relevant to your situation by following the links and analyzing the text, analyzing the images on those pages. And that is the only way, I think, that we can deal with the massive amount of data that's out there, is to have machines reading it for us. It's just too overwhelming for our brains to...
Isn't that exactly what the marketing tools do already, though? I don't find it any accident that, you know, I'll be looking up a particular topic, suicide, for example, for this last show that I just did. And then all of a sudden, in the sidebar of my Facebook, here comes all these suicide prevention hotlines and stuff.
Right, they're trying They've already done that. The problem is that they are feeding it to you and distracting you from what you're trying to do. They're using it as a way to suck you in. They're using it as a way to sell you something, because that's how they make money, and that's how their AI is optimized. It's all a question of how you optimize the algorithms. If the algorithms are tuned and trained to optimize for what you need, then the outcome will be very different. The outcome will be supportive of what you need when you need it, not to distract you, but to augment what you're doing in your real life at any given time, and done in such a way that it's not trying to sell you anything. It's not trying to convince you of anything. It's trying to support you. That is the fundamental shift. Right now, we have a lot of technologies that are trying to, or a lot of implementations of these technologies that are trying to basically exploit humans and reap profits from getting something out of human beings. And the technologies are not inherently bad. We need to start tuning these technologies and turning them to support what the human being needs.
There's a thing about human nature. I don't want to be idealistic. You spoke a little while ago about the individuation of Facebook, the individual centeredness of Facebook. And I just want to throw out there that not everyone uses it that way. I don't know how, because I've never looked into it, but Elizabeth West, for example, doesn't have a profile, but she has a page for her channeling work. And speaking of Elizabeth West, let's pause our discussion of the virtual world and take 10 minutes to enjoy some real-world presence. Your mic is live, Elizabeth.
Hi, Susan. Today I have a sunset windows practice that I call simply kindness. Very short and sweet. Now, when we offer kindness to someone else just because, it's a great gift, but we don't need to wait for that impulse to arise organically. We can create more kindness and experience more kindness in our lives if we want to. In this particular time and place, more kindness begins to look fairly essential to me. And I don't think it takes that much. If it's something you are looking for in your life, if it's something you value, if you want a kinder world and you're willing to invest of your own time and energy to support it, this is a very easy way to do that. This practice takes just minutes to do, but it may require a bit more self-discipline than some of the others. But I find that the rewards are much greater than one might expect, given the minimal investment that you will make, particularly over time. If you use this practice periodically, you are likely to begin to perceive a sweeter and kinder world. And given the objective reality that we are most often in touch with, that is a wonderful thing. So here's how this one works. When you get up in the morning, choose one small act of kindness that you would like to offer today. It can be to another human being, to an animal, to the planet, to your community, to God. The choices are endless. You might want to make a commitment to greeting someone who doesn't often get noticed, calling or writing an appreciation to someone who isn't expecting it, cleaning up a bit of trash in your neighborhood for 5 minutes, taking your dog somewhere she loves to go, feeding the squirrels, making a donation of time or money that you've put off, putting an offering of food in a food bank bin at the grocery store, or putting the most perfect peach you can find on your altar. Doesn't matter. Let your heart direct you and try not to pick something that sounds right, but rather choose an act that makes you feel happy, makes your heart sing when you contemplate it. Can be the simplest of actions. And then the next thing is you just do it. But here's the other thing. Before you go out and undertake your day, also set an intention to notice any small acts of kindness that you encounter. They may be offered to you or to the earth or to another. They may even be offered by the earth or by an animal or a body of water or the sun. Just decide that you are going to keep your heart open to seeing the acts of kindness that are around you during the day. And then I suggest that before you go to sleep at night, you do a quick review. What did you actually do? How did it feel? What did you see others doing in the way of kindnesses? How did it feel to see them? If you forgot all about it, don't fret. Just wake up tomorrow and start again. It's never too late to be kind, and it's never too late to receive the kindnesses that are daily showered upon us all. And that's it. Now, personally, I have found that this increases my awareness of the things that I want and I choose to see as I make my way through a day, through a life. I've also noticed that I find it easier to engage in acts of kindness, that rather than it being an effort to do, they become their own joy. It really helped me a lot to write down what I plan to do, although in most cases I did quite a bit more once I got started, and it helped me to sum up what I observed and received at the end of the day. The writing of it at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, just a couple minutes, was for me very useful in terms of keeping myself aware. And perhaps the most extraordinary part of it was the amazing plethora of offerings of kindness that were literally strewn in my path, Susan. Everywhere I went, everywhere I looked. And without this practice, I was walking through so much goodness, so much kindness, so much generosity, and not experiencing it, not feeling that warmth, that delight, that connectedness that was there. So, for instance, one day I was watering my garden, and there was this gorgeous iridescent hummingbird hovering over the spray. And I realized that that was a gift. That bird was there just a few feet away from me, and it was so beautiful. It was so deeply touching for me to have it come so close. And I could have seen that as simply the bird's acting in its own self-interest, trying to be close to the water. Or I could have seen it as a random occurrence, or I could have received it as an incredible moment of connection and beauty. And so with this practice in mind, I was actually that much richer, happier, more grateful, regardless of what the hummingbird's intention was. So by looking around me, by looking around for what was being offered, I was much enriched, much happier, much more joyful.
There's something about kindness, something about beauty that actually fills me with sadness. And I notice some resistance coming up in me to what you're saying, because I don't want to say afraid, it's not exactly fear, but there's some trepidation about confronting my guilt if you will, as a human being, as a member of the species that has so badly fouled its nest. When I see something like that hummingbird, when I see something like a gorgeous landscape, It fills my heart with sadness.
Wisdom from Walden. Ask how those who suffer privation handle all their frustration. The answer they're giving, most people are living lives of quiet desperation. Hee-haw!
I can understand that, and I have experienced that as well. So I'm not sure that that's not valuable, but I think that it is a particular perspective, particular vantage. You're looking at that hummingbird and you're feeling, I think I'm understanding this correctly, some weight of responsibility for having basically destroyed its habitat, its ability to be free, to be itself, to spread its wings and to live and enjoy itself. And this is just my perspective, Susan, but I'm not sure that staying in that place adds anything to the overall energetic of our planet, of our existence, of our connected web. By feeling that grief, we can use that grief or that guilt to motivate us to do something differently, to live differently, and to interact differently. But being stuck or remaining in that sorrow or that guilt just adds more sorrow and guilt to the world. And from my point of view, when we can add more joy and more delight and more beauty in this time, particularly when that window is closing, I think that's an offering in and of itself. I think that adds to everyone's experience in this world in a subtle way.
Well, thank you for using the word stuck, because that's the way it feels. I feel like I'm stuck in the sorrow and in the guilt. And I hear you suggesting it as a way to access compassion.
Compassion and connection. You know, if we stick with that hummingbird for a moment, it's my belief, and obviously I don't know, but it's my belief that that hummingbird harbors no grudges and blames us, not at all.
Oh, maybe. I think that's so true. I think it takes language in order to blame. It's just your other practices tend to access this joy through the commonplace. Whereas when I go for the stunningly beautiful, I feel like there's a lapse in entitlement. When I take something commonplace and find beauty in it, I've somehow given it something. Whereas I haven't given that hummingbird squat.
Well, and I think by receiving it, you are giving it something.
Yeah. There's a poem and Ruth Babermeyer about, when you take from me, you give me your receiving.
Yes, yes, beautiful. Yes, yes, it is like that. And I think with this practice, that was just one suggestion, but maybe somebody holds a door open for you when you've got too many bags, or someone smiles at you on the street, or the wind comes just when you're hottest and sweatiest and caresses your cheek. And you're like, wow, how did it know to do that just when I needed it? Or maybe it didn't know, but it is this beautiful offering and I can accept it as a kindness as opposed to just a random happenstance. I can become enriched by what is around me, not just enriched, but almost enwrapped, enrobed in the loving kindness that does exist in other human beings and in other forms of life in this world.
Yeah, I love your emphasis on the non-human. That's very refreshing.
And the other thing about this practice is that there's a balance. You know, the idea is that you go and do something kind too. And it can be a little thing. It can just be, I'm going to smile at three people who I don't know during the course of my outing today. And I'm going to smile from my heart if I can. I'm going to do my best. I'm going to offer that as a kindness that I don't need to do, but I can do. So there's a balance of making that offering yourself.
I have a practice that I do next to nature. That's kind of like that. No matter where I'm going or if there's a squirrel scampering across the lawn, I stop and I offer my full presence to that squirrel.
Gorgeous.
That's kind of like a gift that I'm giving that squirrel. Whether or not that squirrel receives it as a gift is irrelevant. I'm offering my presence in the spirit of a gift.
Yeah, That's a perfect example of the kind of offering of kindness that this practice speaks to.
Well, okay. On behalf of Sequitur's listeners, thank you so much for the kindness practice, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Whether with the Sunset Windows practices or the daily readings from her book, Love is the Way, I find that centering with Elizabeth reminds me who I really am. I have that same kind of tear going on that you talked about. You've got your high school friends over here and you got your family over there. Some people get around that by having multiple identities on Facebook.
So presence will not force people to integrate all their identities. I'm calling them personas. I hope someday we can do that and we can just be accepted for who we are.
I don't put all my activist stuff on my timeline. I have Occupy Together Activist Support, a Facebook group.
Right. Yeah.
Interact in that way. So, and it's often the same people, but it's just, you know, I don't use my timeline that way.
Yeah. So we're definitely taking that into account. And that reminds me, one of my partners and I are putting together a field study. We want to do basically field research to have discussions just like this with a lot of different people that use social media in many different ways to really understand better what would be the best solution to bring forward. So I would invite you to be part of that.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, you mentioned LinkedIn. I don't do LinkedIn, although every time I threaten to shut it down, something halfway interesting happens. I find LinkedIn very wage slave oriented.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
And as a retired person, I really have no need for that kind of interaction. I don't really care that somebody got a new job. That's their problem, you know? And the other one, of course, is Twitter. I was active on Twitter, and I did end up dropping off of that. Here to Hear Empath was my handle. And I picked that up during the Occupy movement for the instant availability to people, and found that that same instant availability was driving me bananas. And so I was only on Twitter for a matter of months before I said, enough of that. But Facebook, it's kind of like, I don't care if you like Facebook, don't like Facebook. If that's where your community hangs out, that's where you need to be.
Right. It's like the phone book 30 years ago. If you weren't in the phone book, you didn't exist. Like, nobody could contact you. So
now you can't even find a phone book.
Right. There's no phone book because everybody's on Facebook. Facebook has 2 billion unique logins per month. That's a quarter of the planet is logging into Facebook each month. So they wield tremendous power over what people are thinking. Their AI is driving the nootropic space of our planet.
Maybe it's a quarter of the planet. We just finished naming the fact that people have multiple Facebook identities.
Yeah.
So one person might be responsible for any number of those so-called unique logins.
That's true, but it's certainly well past the morphogenic threshold, if you like, the theory of morphogenesis, which is that once a certain number of individuals pick up on an idea, then that idea is suddenly available to everyone.
Yeah, I've seen estimates of critical mass as being somewhere in the neighborhood of 11%.
So if Facebook wants all the humans on the planet to think something, all they have to do is get their AI optimized to promote it, and it will happen. I mean, there are some who would say that's what happened in our last presidential election. You know, I think there's a lot of factors there, and I don't really want to get into it, but it's a lot of power. That's why we need to defend ourselves, you know, and I don't want to be antagonistic toward Facebook. In fact, I think there's a lot of good interaction happening on Facebook that couldn't otherwise happen. I think that's awesome. There's no reason to shut that down just because some people are feeling depressed and isolated. So it's not an issue with Facebook. It's more an issue of protection.
I'd want to wrap up with any requests that you have of our listeners for how they can support the development of presence. I noticed at the end of your website, for example, there's a thing about join our team. What are you looking for from people?
I'm looking for mostly at this point, people who may be passionate about the mission, because right now I can't take investment in the traditional way. I am looking at other forms of possibly funding this. So I'm looking for people who are excited about this kind of a mission and can bring their skills to bear on it. What kind of skills do I need? Well, I need software developers. I need web developers. I need people who can help us project manage. I need people who can manage money. I need people who are good at networking, people who are good at marketing, you know, right now it's just very early days and I've got to build a whole kind of organization that can move on all fronts, you know, in order to release something effectively. Customer support is another area. So if people start signing up left and right, they're going to have questions. And especially with some of the things we're talking about doing, you know, that are a bit different from the way people think about social media today. You know, and it doesn't stop with social media. It's not just like another social media thing. Again, the base mission is about the agent that interfaces for you, that intermediates for you with the electronic world to help your brain deal with this gigantic, vast repository of data and ever-flowing feeds of information that your brain was not evolved to be connected directly to.
And if somebody would like to talk to you more in depth on a personal level, what should they do?
There's a contact form on the website that leads directly to me. So just fill out the form, say, hey, I'm really interested. I want to talk. I want to help. Or if people have any connections that want to get involved in this, it's awesome.
And the website is?
PresenceTools.com.
All one word, no punctuation.
All one word, no punctuation, except the dot.
Okay.
So that's PresenceTools.com. Once again, Strobus, I thank you for inviting the Sequitur podcast in on the ground floor of this exciting new enterprise. I've filled out your contact form and hope that some of our listeners will be moved to do the same. And I invite you back for a follow-up report in 3 months or whenever you're ready to go public with Presence.
Here's a truth which you can't disavow. In the end, life is no cat's meow. It's getting quite late for accepting your fate. Let me know if you figure out how. Hee-haw!
Thanks are also due to Elizabeth West for her Sunset Windows practice titled Kindness, to Peter, Paul, and Mary for their original arrangement of a winter holiday classic, to Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary, and to Zimt for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Us then that there is no seeking, 'cause what connects us is one.